KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Stand-up comedian Mike Birbiglia is used to having total control over his material, so he found it quite disconcerting when documentary filmmaker Eddie Schmidt started following him around with a camera.
When you have someone else directing and editing and producing your story, it's an extraordinary level of trust, and I felt deeply uncomfortable almost throughout, and so it's a testament to Eddie that he's just a very zen person, that he talked me down from the ledge probably 5 or 6 times.
Birbiglia and Schmidt talked to Eric Deggans about adapting a popular comedy podcast into the new Peacock special, Good One, a show about jokes. They also talk about sticking with the truth in autobiographical comedy, following allegations that Hasan Minhaj falsified elements of his award-winning stand-up special, Homecoming King. But first we banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined with my partner in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So let's talk about Francis Ford Coppola, who had a longstanding dream to make this film called Megalopolis. And he got some very A-list people because, of course, he's a god in the movie world. But he decided to do something at 80-something years old that you are told nobody in Hollywood should ever do. And that is, he decided to pay with his own money. You know, OPM, other people's money, that's like the mantra in Hollywood. And he spent quite a lot of it, $100 million plus, we understand. And they had this screening where I understand Coppola was expecting, he invited all the studio heads and some relatives and actors and whatnot. I'm told he was expecting someone to just pick it up and say, we will distribute this film. But that didn't seem to happen.
No, and there is no indication, at least as of now, that anyone is interested in distributing this film. The screening did not go over well. I mean, people are walking this very fine line because obviously everyone has tremendous respect for him, The Godfather, Apocalypse Now, you know, go on and on. But he is 84 years old. This was a passion project. It played very much like an idiosyncratic art film. You know, it's dystopian. It's got lots of themes and nudity and a bunch of things that are turning off a mainstream audience of studio executives. And the question is Coppola going to have to eat a lot of this money in order to get this movie actually released?
I mean, if he wants it in theaters, we're told he wants tens of millions being spent on a marketing campaign, which is a normal thing, that he would like the suitor for this film that hasn't come forward to pay. I don't know if he would ante up more of his money. I don't know. He spent a lot of his money. I think he sold some of his winery interests, but I don't know what he's got left. But still, you know, $100 million is a lot for the negative cost. And then for the marketing, more. You know, I talked to a lot of people who were at that screening, and I got from one person saying, I mean, these were people who are high-level people in the industry, you know, saying it was painful. It was such a shame to see it because this shouldn't be the way he ends his career. Not that he necessarily is ending his career. We've seen people like Clint Eastwood go on, but he hasn't done much directing in recent years, and we don't know how much more he'll do. And then a couple of people said, you know, I thought it had good ideas. It's about something, and suggesting that it will take time for the audience to appreciate, like, you know, Blade Runner, I think one of them cited as a movie that didn't do that well and then became a cult thing and a very admired film. So I just don't know what happens here, but no one I talked to said they were going to make any effort to buy the film. I think some people are wondering if one of the streamers will take it, maybe Apple, which tends to spend, you know, a lot of money on things that don't always work out.
Well, and there's a path here if he wants to self-finance the P&A for this film. I mean, Kevin Costner is doing that on Horizon, the two-part series that's coming out this summer. Now, he got Warner Brothers to distribute this domestically, and they're only putting up a little bit of money. I mean, Costner raised most of this money himself. So there is a path forward there. It just doesn't seem like that's what Coppola wants. One interesting thing is he's going to take this movie to Cannes, yes, which he said he wasn't going to do unless it had a distributor. Now, he'll be at Cannes, and maybe the French will, you know, be the contrary voices here and embrace the film, and it will turn into you know, an artiste masterpiece. But we'll see what happens in France.
Yes, we'll see what happens. And from what I know about Kevin Costner, he will make an attempt for this to be a commercial film or a pair of films. I'm not sure Coppola thinks that way. And based on what I heard, he didn't in this case, certainly.
No, nor does he need to. Listen, the man's made a fortune in the wine business. If this is how he wants to spend his money rather than buying private jets or an island in the Hawaiian Islands, like, more power to him.
Yeah. Speaking of an island in the Hawaiian Islands, Larry Ellison owns one of those, this very wealthy Larry Ellison. And as you know, his son David is making a bid to buy not Paramount, but National Amusements, which controls Paramount. And what we are seeing now, they've set aside a month to talk it over. Shari Redstone seems to favor David Ellison, who's been a partner with Paramount on things like, you know, Top Gun, Mission Impossible. You know, he's become more and more successful as he's learned the business. However, people I talk to, and I'm sure people you talk to, say this will undoubtedly lead to a shareholder suit, because by buying Shari's company and then having the company buy his company, Skydance, a lot of regular investors who aren't Shari Redstone are going to get screwed. So the lawsuit seems like it's coming, and it seems like some of the directors at Paramount may in fact foresee that.
Yeah, we had three people who, according to the Wall Street Journal this week, are going to step down from not just the board of Paramount. They are on the special committee that is evaluating these offers. And there was a big push from the Paramount leadership to go with a $26 billion offer from Apollo, the private equity firm. And National Amusements, which controls Paramount, has said, no, we're not doing that. We're going to stick with the Ellison bid. So, you know, National Amusements can do this, and they have in the past. They have replaced board members because they control the board. So Shari Redstone can just put board members in there to do what she wants. But again, if some of these more aggravated shareholders decide to sue, she's going to have a problem.
Yeah. I mean, we saw her do that with Philippe Domon, who was looting the Paramount, and she got rid of him and she put her own board in place. But this is going to be a litigation, it seems to me, if it happens. And especially...
It might. Or listen, Larry Ellison has a big checkbook. Maybe he writes a check and these aggrieved shareholders go away.
I think the only reason he's in this right now, from what I understand, is because it's not an outright purchase and it's this, you know, pay $2 billion for National Amusements. So I don't think that will happen. I mean, Shari Redstone is saying she doesn't necessarily believe that the other bidder has the money to pay the $26 billion. But, you know, this is the kind of thing that could end up in court. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, founding partner of Puck News. Update: after we bantered, another board member stepped down, making it four so far. Comedian Mike Birbiglia's brand of comedy tends to be personal. In his 2008 one-man show, Sleepwalk With Me, he talked about a disorder that led to him sleepwalking out of a second-story window. In his 2022 show, The Old Man and the Pool, he opened up about the impact of being diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. It may come as a surprise that Birbiglia wasn't comfortable being put under the microscope by documentary filmmaker Eddie Schmidt for their new Peacock special. Good One, a show about jokes, traces the comedian's process of bringing a show to life. Schmidt, who has worked on Netflix docuseries like Ugly Delicious and Chelsea Does, shot Birbiglia writing and trying out new material in front of an audience. He also interviews members of Birbiglia's family and his peers in comedy, like Seth Meyers and Hasan Minhaj. Early in the special, Birbiglia sifts through a box of old journals and explains how he develops material.
Like, a majority of it is just writing something down about how you feel and then rereading them later and seeing if there's anything of value that's worth saying or on stage. Like, in a full journal like this, there might be one line that's like anything. With all of this, you're creating clay to make a sculpture. But if you didn't have clay, you couldn't make a sculpture. And so this is the dirt.
Mike Birbiglia and Eddie Schmidt spoke with Eric Deggans about making their new Peacock show, Good One, a show about jokes.
So what struck me about this is, you know, watching this special where we see Mike trying out jokes and we see him trying to figure out what the arc of his next special might be, whatever it is. There's a lot of different podcasts and products out there that talk about this process of making comedy. And I wanted to ask you guys maybe I'll start with Eddie first and then go to Mike. Why are people so interested in this in the first place? Because you might think on one level it's like watching a magician explain how they do a trick. So why are people so interested in this process of how comedy gets invented?
Well, I think people are interested in process generally. I think if you love something, you're really curious how it comes together. And I think comedy, like music, whether you're a singer-songwriter or whether if you're a great chef, you know, things arrive fully developed into the culture, but they're the product of a lot of hard work and a lot of personal inspiration. And so I think for me, as certainly as a documentary filmmaker, I want to chronicle process, but I also think that process is very visual and tactile. And I wanted that to be on screen here in Good One.
And Mike, when I bring the question to you, were you uncomfortable at all opening up your process to cameras? Because as a journalist, I've tried to get, you know, Colbert's Late Show, other shows to let me sit in the writer's room. And that's one of the things that they really resist. They don't like having journalists around watching that whole process. Yeah. And so I'm wondering, did you have any trepidation going into this?
Oh my God, so much. Yeah. I mean, to build on what Eddie's saying, it's interesting to watch any process for a certain type of viewer. Like, I don't know if you folks saw the Wim Wenders film Perfect Days recently. It's a beautiful, beautiful film. It's not a documentary, but it's sort of a meditative day in the life of someone who cleans public washrooms in Japan. And of course, I don't know much about that, but you can get lost in someone's world and process and way of thinking. So yeah, I agree with Eddie on that point. And then in relation to like the resistance, I realized from doing the project how much resistance I have to doing it. Because as a storyteller, you're always telling your version of a story and you're editing it. And so it's not the story, it's a version of the story. And so when you have someone else directing and editing and producing your story, it's an extraordinary level of trust. And I felt deeply uncomfortable almost throughout. And so it's a testament to Eddie that he's just a very zen person, that he talked me down from the ledge probably 5 or 6 times.
And Mike, I get the sense that like, that's where your art lives too, though. Like you're deeply uncomfortable all the time, aren't you?
Yeah, I'd say the majority of the time. I mean, I was... Ira Glass came on to my Working It Out podcast for the 100th episode, and he said this thing that I thought was sort of hilarious. He goes, you know, the thing that you don't express on stage is that, you know, you seem so calm on stage, but in real life, you're so anxious all the time. And I go, yeah, because I am calm on stage. When I'm on stage, I'm in control. It's like there's a microphone. I'm the only person talking. I've prepared some jokes. I know they're pretty decent. You know, and life is not like that at all. I mean, it's like there, you know, torrential downpours and your car won't work. And, you know, it's like just like endless problems. And oddly, comedy shows are more predictable than that.
It's your safe haven. That's awesome.
It is.
So, Eddie, the special, of course, originated as a Vulture podcast. It's called Good One, a podcast about jokes. And so I'm wondering, how did this idea sort of arise of trying to make a televised special out of a podcast about jokes?
Well, I love comedy. I've been fortunate to work with a lot of funny people and have a deep appreciation for who they are and what they do. And I think in the podcast, I saw something extraordinary in terms of what Jesse David Fox was doing as a journalist looking at process. And he was, you know, really skilled at kind of crafting an arc through that conversation. And just because I think visually, I immediately felt I want to see the things that are being discussed. You know, as we see in the show with Mike, we see note cards and journals. And when I heard the podcast episodes, I wanted to go and meet the people that were being discussed, the collaborators, the family members that were the wellspring of humor. And so it just sort of, to me, naturally lent itself to being translated from a conversation to sort of an immersive, you know, documentary format, to where you sort of ride along with the comedian as life unfolds.
Mike, what I wanted to ask you was, it's not till the very end of the special that you call yourself an autobiographical comedian. And even though, you know, of course, I'm aware of how comics can turn the things in their lives into stories and jokes, I'd never quite heard anybody put it that way and define it so tightly that way. And it made me think, you know, I just reviewed the new Steve Martin documentary that Morgan Neville did. And as I was watching it, I thought to myself, you know, I didn't learn anything really about Steve Martin's life from his comedy work when he was a stand-up. Because he was entirely playing a character.
Yeah.
And, you know, you didn't really learn much about like Johnny Carson or Bob Hope or even George Carlin, you know, Richard Pryor, yeah. But a lot of those comedy greats, you didn't learn much about what their life actually was like because it didn't fuel their comedy. I wanted to ask you, does this feel like a relatively new thing? And what separates an autobiographical comic from a more typical stand-up comic?
I think that, you know, there was a piece of advice that a friend of mine, one of my early mentors in comedy in New York City, Lucian Hold, gave me early in my career. And he said, if you write jokes about your own life, no one can steal them. And I think it's true. And I think that's when I really started to dig deep on just writing jokes about my own life. I think we're in a different era than Johnny Carson in the sense that I think that comedy is wildly accessible, wildly popular, and ubiquitous. And I think that the odds of there being crossover between what you wrote and what someone else wrote are actually really high at this point. You know, I wrote a joke, I think, for my last special, my Netflix special, The Old Man in the Pool, about WebMD.com. And there was like, I performed at Princeton University. And this student who's, I think, an aspiring comedian said, you know, that's a meme. Your WebMD joke is a meme. And it's like, I didn't know that. And then I like looked it up. It was like, oh, yeah. It's like definitely some other people have gotten to this idea. And I do think that that's part of the reason why I've leaned towards autobiographical. I think also there's like a, it's not me originally saying it, but I think it's political to be personal in a certain way. But by not talking about politics and talking about a human experience, that's a statement also about the degree to which we do have the ability as human beings who may have 10 things that we fiercely disagree about to connect on in the sphere of art and humor.
Coming up after the break, Mike Birbiglia addresses the backlash following revelations that Hasan Minhaj embellished the truth in his show, Homecoming King. And he talks about where he draws the line in telling the truth in autobiographical comedy. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. In the Peacock special, Good One, a show about jokes, documentary filmmaker Eddie Schmidt follows comedian Mike Birbiglia as he develops a stand-up special. Birbiglia and Schmidt are talking to Eric Deggans about making the special and more.
So I wanted to ask about one thing, and I'll understand if you don't want to talk about it, but of course you got Hasan Minhaj in the special. And he went through a certain kind of scandal where there was reporting that suggested that some of the autobiographical stuff in some of his Netflix specials might not have been entirely based on things that actually happened. And he admitted exaggerating some things, but also pushed back on a lot of the criticism. And I don't want to delve into the details of that, but I do want to ask, it raises the question of how important is it that when you tell autobiographical stuff, that it is true or mostly true, And do you have a sense of when you shade something to the point where largely the story didn't quite happen the way you told it? Are you worried about that at all? Is this an issue for you, or do you think that maybe there was too much made of it?
Yeah, I love Hassan, and it's a big comic, it's a good friend. First of all, if you put anyone's autobiographical or semi-autobiographical shows up to any scrutiny, you would not have the same level of veracity that you have with a good documentary. Right. So it's sort of an odd choice on the part of the journalist to not contextualize that swimming in Cambodia was never fact-checked, that Live from the Sunset Strip was never fact-checked. You know, I would describe that, and I love the New Yorker, but it was a very sweaty choice on their part to publish that. You know, David Sedaris is, I think, one of our greatest living autobiographical humorists, and people ask him whether what he's saying is true. He says, true enough for you. True enough for you. Which is, I think, a great joke unto itself. And that's where it's oddly where I place the truth of my own act. So, like, I think every comedian or humorist has to decide what their level of accuracy is. And what, you know, so everybody has their own. Every single comedian has their own line. For me, if it starts to affect the audience and what their choices might be, is when I start to second guess and make sure that I'm being very specifically accurate. So in my last special on Netflix, The Old Man in the Pool, I talk about having type 2 diabetes, and I talk about how I did some things in my life that resulted in me reversing the type 2 diabetes. That's an example of something that I would never fictionalize at all.
Right.
And the reason I wouldn't fictionalize is I do not want someone coming to my show who has diabetes and seeing me say that, and then they're trying to reverse their diabetes and going, well, right, this isn't working. He said that he did, you know, to me, that would make me feel awful. And so this is a real thing that happened to me, and I'm just relaying it to you, and you can take it how you want it, but I'm not going to lie about that, you know. Same thing goes for my sleepwalking disorder. I sleepwalk through a second story window, and that was the subject of Sleepwalk With Me, my first feature film and solo show. I would never say, you know, when the Hassan thing happened, I got a whole bunch of text messages from friends going, I really hope you sleepwalk through that window.
You're like, why would I make that up?
And I did.
So I'm wondering, and I don't know if this is an Eddie or a Mike question, is this just a special, or is this something that you might try to do with other comics? We've seen one very specific and really involved and detailed process. Is this something you might want to try to do with other people who develop material in different ways?
I'll answer that one and say, absolutely. Yeah. It's hopefully so special that we get to do more. I mean, I think we always felt like there are lots of great stories to tell like this with different comics at different points in their careers and lives. And I think what's cool about it is that it's active and it's at a pivot point. I always think as a documentarian, I want to get in on the story when something is about to happen. That's really the exciting thing, when something is around the corner and you're not quite sure what it's going to be, because then you're seeing things being processed in real time. And most things about comedians, most things about artists or famous people in general are looks back. They're biographies. They're told, you know, looking in the rearview mirror. But for me, I love cinema verite, and I love filming things as they unfold. And that is super exciting to capture, and I think really exciting to watch.
And Mike, I wanted to ask you, I mean, one of the things, of course, that comes through in this special is how long it takes you to actually go from working it out to actually having a special or having a, I don't know, a presentation that you would want to take to the stage and have it be a complete work. Will we ever see the stuff that we're seeing in this special in a completed work? Are you driving towards that now?
It's so funny you should say that, because when I watched it, I was like, oh, I don't think almost any of these jokes are in my current special, which is actually part of what makes it so special that we did, like Eddie's saying, that you capture a moment in time and you don't know what you're going to find. But that it all, yeah, it does take, you know, I generally take about 3 or 4 years to hone the special. And part of the reason I do is because I feel like there's so much stuff in the universe, like we were just saying, that I feel like if you're asking for an hour of people's time, it's like you should give them something you worked on for a lot of time and you really care about. So that's my theory on it all.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it's why, I mean, when you finally do get a project together, it's so polished and so well put together because you spent so much time thinking about it.
Thanks.
Definitely. Definitely. So what you're saying is if you do come up with something, there won't be anything in this special that'll be in it.
It doesn't seem like it. I don't. There might be one or two jokes, but
I think that's actually really cool. And by the way, one of the things, because Mike's shows, his finished shows that he puts out are so polished, one of the joys was getting to see him be loose and try things and have fun. I think it was a great side of him, and I'm really glad that we were able to capture.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it does feel like a magic trick to those of us who are not professionally funny to see you walk on stage and sort of say, well, I just have these ideas. And it feels like a thought out, planned out stand-up set. It does feel like a magic trick sometimes when you watch it. And I also wanted to ask you, Mike, we also seem to have this moment in comedy, you know, you sort of briefly referenced politics, but we do seem to have this moment in comedy where there are some comics who believe that pushing back against orthodoxy is like kind of what they're about. And they're not necessarily talking about Trump or talking about Biden, but they're talking about liberal orthodoxy and what they can say and what they can't say. And there's a lot of tension around whether that is liberating or whether people are actually making an argument for punching down on marginalized groups. And I was wondering, I mean, of course, your shows are very autobiographical and you're just talking about your personal stuff. But I was wondering what you think about that and if you've ever been tempted to get in and engage in that debate the way that, I mean, everyone from Neil Brennan to Bill Maher has talked about it in different ways.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not so interested in that. I mean, I think one of the things that's happened in the last 23 years since I moved to New York City and to pursue comedy professionally is that the art form has changed. There's been a seismic shift in comedy. It went from being a nightclub backroom thing to being a majorly popular art form. I mean, like, it's huge. You even watch that, like, Kevin Hart, Chris Rock documentary with Chappelle recently on Netflix. You go, oh my God, they're playing Madison Square Garden. I mean, the comedy is so big. It's so big. And I think as a result, you have so many different types of comedy. So you have people like Chappelle or Bill Maher who are provocateurs in their goals and in their interests. You have people like me who tell stories about my life and try to find a meaning in that. And you have people like Kate Berlant and John Early who do completely absurdist comedy, you know, in a brilliant way. And countless other kinds of comedy, you know. And so the funny thing about this moment in time where people are, the provocateurs are saying the provocative things, and then people ask people like me, they go, hey, what do you think of this provocative thing? I don't know. That's not what I'm doing. But, you know, I like that there's a lot of comedy.
I hear you. Well, I have to thank Eddie, you and Mike, for joining us here. I could talk to you about this stuff all day. I say this in every interview, but I really mean it. I could talk to you. I could nerd out about comedy with you guys all day.
Right back at you.
Yeah, us too.
Mike Birbiglia is the comic and subject of Good One, a show about jokes. And Eddie Schmidt is the director of the special, which is now streaming on Peacock. So I want to thank both of you guys for joining us on The Business.
Loved it. Thank you so much for talking.
And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from Phil Richards and Nick Lamponi, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW shows on kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.